for the general parsha. Next parsha, next parak, we're going to meet the house of Achav. So it gets much more exciting. We start to get into Eliyahu territory and Achav territory. But we should really. I'll just go lightly on the subject that we're going on here. And certainly, if anybody has any insights, or we have good English translations, feel free to kick in. But I'm going to start off essentially with the simple read, and then take a look at some interesting ideas that one could get out of it, and of course, which dovetail with my own theories, which is, I admit, not really fair of me to pile one theory on top of another theory, but what could I do? Be'itahi chala aviyah ben Yeravam. In that day, the son of the king, Aviyah, became sick. And the idea, obviously, the word chala doesn't just mean he became sick, it means he became sick to the point of death. Now, we've never met Achiyah. We've never met him. We have to assume that this is sometime in the future, when things are on the way. Although it's hard to say chronologically what's going on, because it's really very much a separate story from the story that existed before. One has to assume, however, it's after the Beit El incident, but it's difficult to say exactly where it is chronologically in the, at the time. The question is, Yeravam, how old was he when he took the throne? I don't think we ever know how old Yeravam was when he takes the throne. Rechavam, we know. Yeravam, we don't know, I don't think. So the question was, did he already have kids beforehand? It's hard to make an assessment. We never find out how old Aviyah is. But there are two interesting things I'd like to point out about Aviyah, and what we need to do is skip to the end of the story in order to see something very interesting. Please skip ahead to verse 19, I think. No, hold on. A little before that. No, I'm looking for the part where they mention Aviyah. It's part of the prophecy, so I think I skipped too far. Here it is. Yeah, 13. The Saftulo, thank you. The Saftulo, and they will mourn, they will eulogize him. We'll get back to this and see who's talking to what. Verse 13, Yud Gimel. Kol Yisrael, the Kavru Oto, and they shall bury him. Vikavru, by the way, this is a Vav HaYipuch, so it reverses things. Kavru means past tense, but Vikavru is future tense, sort of like V'ahavta is you will love, not you loved. Vikavru oto, and you will bury him, you will all bury him. Ki zeh levado yavo l'Yeravam al kaver. He's the only one of Yeravam's family that will get into his grave. We'll find out the rest of them are going to be killed in the most horrible ways, and none of them will be buried, except for Aviyah. Yan nimtza vo davar tov. Because something good was found in him, El Hashem Elokei Yisrael, that is, God found something good in him, Bevet Yeravam. But we never know exactly what Aviyah did, to be honest. We don't have any information about it. So here's a place where, of course, Chazal are going to kick in, because there really is no Masorah. We don't know exactly what it is. I can tell you what Chazal say, and the Mepharshim all bring it down, because again, they were all a little bit in the dark. Chazal say that essentially what he did was he took the troops, there were troops that were lined up to keep people from going to the south to worship in the Beit HaMikdash, and he took those troops away so people could go on Aliyah L'Regel, and there's a second drash that says he himself went on Aliyah L'Regel, which of course gets you into one of those things where, you know, what is God up to type of thing, because if Aviyah was going to be the next ruler, then why would God want him to die? If God allowed him to live, that may have improved the situation. It may have improved the situation. So then we get into another tricky philosophical question, which is, do sons die for their father's sins? Of course, in Devarim it says never, but but we have another pasuk that says ad shilei shein bad ribayim. You get it for 3 and 4. So this is a very complex issue, and I'm not really going to fully explore it right now. However, I think the best possible answer was one that I heard from a Yoshua Maori who heads the Bible department in Haifa University, and I don't think he said it on his own. I think he's quoting other people. But he said that essentially what you have in the Torah is when the son dies for the father, it's not the son dying for the father, it's the father dying. That is, when a father commits a sin and is punished, part of that punishment is to watch the family go. I don't want to be again overly simplistic here, but it's, if somebody drives very badly, it's not only the driver that pays the price, which then gets you into issues of David. When David commits a sin at the end of Shmuel, and God gives them a choice to have a whole nation suffer, the famous question is, why the collective punishment? And the answer may be, because just like a father pays for a father's sins are paid by his family's house, because it's not collective punishment at all, it's part of the same organic entity, if you will, so too when a king commits a sin, he has to accept the idea that his immediate organic entity is his country, and his country pays the price. I don't think that's such a far-fetched idea, even in modern politics, to be perfect, in modern government. I think that's an idea which I happen to find comfortable, and I think it solves a lot of the problems that one comes across in Tanakh. Avia probably would have been a better king, but sometimes you pay the price for what dad is going to do. The only benefit he got was the fact that he was buried properly rather than destroyed, as we'll see the rest of the family being destroyed. I'm not here to justify, I can't justify God. Eof couldn't do it, and neither could his three crazy friends, and I'm not going to try. But I just want to present you some possible ideas when dealing with these issues, because they're important, I think, religious issues. What's also interesting, by the way, about Avia is take a look at the son of Rechavam. Let's take a look at the son of Rechavam. And for that, we're going to have to skip to chapter 15, I believe.
15?
I believe so. You know, I'm using this in Farshim Tanakh. It only has about 5 sentences per page. I can't see anything. Just a second. I think it's either 15 at the end of 14. Whoever finds it, feel free to give a shout out.
15:9 has Asa.
Asa is his son already. I think Avia is the father. Just a second.
Son of Rechavam.
Son of Rechavam. Am I wrong? Is Asa the son of Rechavam? Where is that?
And that's the very end of your dollar.
That's it's good. At the end of your dollar. Good. That's good.
Vayishkav Rechavam.
Right. At the last sentence, it says Vayishkav Rechavam Yivavotav Yikaver Yivavotav Yerdaviv Shemimo Na'ama Amonit Vayimloch Aviyam Bino Tachdav. What's very interesting is both Rechavam and Yeravam's sons' names are the same. Now, don't be confused by Avia and Aviam, because that switches all the time. That's like Yeshayahu and Yeshaya, and that's like Noam and Noah. You get these kind of changes all the time. The Mem is essentially not a significant. It's not a significant character. It gets added on sort of just for the fun of it. What that means is both the northern king and the southern king are naming their sons the same name. If they both rule, somebody meeting from the north who talks to somebody from the south and somebody from the south talking from the north and say, who's your king? And the answer is, my son's name is Avian. It could be confusing, but it may also be intentional. And the reason why I'm saying it's intentional is we're going to see it a little bit in the future, because we're going to find out that Achav named his son. Achav, there was a king named Achav, a very bad king we're going to meet, and there was a very good king in the south named Yehoshaphat. Now, Yehoshaphat was a righteous king. There's no doubt that he was a righteous dude. And Achav was, to say the least, unrighteous. But they made a peace treaty with each other. They were close, they were friends. In fact, they married their families together, and they both named their sons Yehoram at the same time. The question is, why would you want to do something like that? And my feeling is, it's an attempt to unite the country. That is, it's an attempt to create a tighter geopolitical entity, because both of the, even though you have two kings, they both named the same thing. So if you look at your contract, it's in the fifth year of Aviad that I did something. It creates a feeling of unity. The question is, why would Rechavam would have no interest in doing that unless Rechavam named his kid second? That's possible. Because I can't imagine Yeravam wanting to unite the kingdom. He has no interest. He's not shown any interest in uniting it. It strikes me that if what I'm saying is true, that the reason why they both have the same names was somebody's attempt to create some kind of unification across the political green line, if you will, or purple line, I believe that it would either be Rechavam trying to do it because he felt it would be a good idea. Let's try to unite people so people come back to us. Or it might have been Avia himself, because as we see, what did the Medrash say about him? Avia decided to go and make a pilgrimage to the south. And I'm sure he had a friend there. You know, he spoke to the princes there. And Avia spoke to Aviam. And I don't know. I get the feeling that there may be some kind of reapproachment going on, which of course dies out when Aviam dies. So that gets us back to the story. Let's go back to the story in the beginning of Yud Dalet. So Be'eta Chalavia ben Yeravam. So he gets deathly ill. Of course, Be'eta, he is a funny.
But, you know, you're reading dumb into that, because it doesn't say deathly ill. It just says ill.
That's correct. Although we're going to find out that he's about to die, and it's so bad that Yeravam wants to go to the prophet to see whether he's going to live.
Yeah.
I am reading into it.
Yeah.
Well, what's the? Could I have an English translation?
It just says he's ill.
He fell ill.
He got sick.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. But chalat absolutely does mean simply to be ill. If it weren't for the fact that Yeravam is so worried that he needs to get a prophecy from the prophet to see whether he's going to live, and in fact, Abiyah is going to die as soon as he comes back, I wouldn't have thought so. However, you know, it's an interesting idea. What if? So you're presenting an interesting idea. I always assume that in verse Aleph, he's already deathly ill. And what happens next when they go and they're looking for a prophecy to see whether he's going to live or die was simply useless. It's just as useless. The way you're presenting it is a little bit more sinister, but it's very possible. He was not deathly ill, but because they went to the prophet, that's why the boy had to die. I don't want to judge whether that's correct or not. Let's take a look and see what happens during the story, and let's see which one plays out better. I have to agree that your read of the verse, in most cases that I'm familiar with, when it says chala, that he got sick, it means vayhi ki chala lamut. I believe the word lamut is in most cases of sickness.
Well, lamut is what?
To die. In this case, there is no to die, so therefore...
He was chala miod. It doesn't say that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I've never thought about it before. And I'm saying what that really, if we go according to that reasoning, it makes things a little bit more dark. So let's take a look and see whether that's true. I don't want to negate such a possibility. It's an interesting idea. I just assume because of my knowledge of what happens at the end, retroactively, they must have been sick to death, but I should never have jumped to that conclusion. I think it's a very good insight. I just want to look at Rashi on the spot. Does somebody? I'm just looking at the Mefarshim comments. Is that any of your English commentaries, the ones that have commentaries at the bottom, give a comment about how sick he was or whether he...
No, couldn't say either.
I don't have anything either. Doc skips the whole thing. Rashi skips it. I'll tell you, it's a very interesting insight. It's an interesting insight. Okay, let's see about the story and see what happens.
You were going to say about Beit
Ahi. Yeah, well, Beit Ahi is very certain, because the question is, what does Beit Ahi mean? At that time, is that trying to link it to the? I think the incorrect thing is try to. Whenever you see Beit Ahi, it wasn't that time that you're trying to link it to the previous story. I don't believe that's always justified, and I'll tell you why. Each prophet is writing his story. Probably Achiah HaShiloni, who's about to come into the picture, is writing this prophecy himself, and his prophecy said Beit Ahi. He may have had something in mind that Yirmiyahu, when he put the book together and put the chapter 13 of the Beit El incident, followed by this chapter, may not have had in mind. I just want you to notice that the words Beit Ahi or Vayihi Bayamim Ahayim does not necessarily mean that there's a connection, as opposed to Vayihi Achar Advarim Ahila. You see something like that, you want to assume that there's a connection, but Beit Ahi may just mean that that's the way that Achiah started off his story. His story was later subsumed into the overall story when the book was put together. Yeah, okay. I wouldn't say that because I get into trouble. No, I think that probably Achiah had something in mind, but because the book was written from Achiah's material 250 years after Achiah died, you may not always know what the context is. Anyway, continuing on. Pasuk Bet. Vayomer Yeravam Lishto Kumi Na V'Hishtanit. I want you to get up now, and I want you to dress up. I want you to change yourself. V'lo Yedu, and they won't know, Ki'at Eshet Yeravam, that you are the wife of Yeravam. V'halach Shiloh, and go to Shiloh. Hine Sham Achiah Navi, you'll find Achiah Navi. Now to repeat, Achiah Navi is the one who instigated the rebellion in the first place. He's the one who told Yeravam that he's supposed to split off and form a kingship, and he's supposed to follow in God. What's interesting, however, is in last chapter when we met the prophet from the south, and a prophet from the north, Achiah was nowhere to be found. Now, I realize that it's a Beit El and Shiloh, but it's not that far. The truth is you can even walk it in good conditions from Beit El and Shiloh. It's only, I don't know, about a 4 or 5 hour walk. So the question is, where is Achiah during the entire Egel incident? So continue on, just to... What's that?
What are the implications of him being, of instigating a rebellion?
What do you mean, what...
Put that in.
What I mean is that he was the right-hand man of Yeravam. Yeravam was he was Yeravam's confidant, Yeravam's guide, Yeravam's advisor. The question is, why is he not involved in the stories. When Ahav does something bad, Eliyahu is always there, even though he's going to sometimes risk his own life. That's the job of a prophet. Not every prophet was a king's prophet, but most of them were. The job of a king's prophet is to tell the king what to do. Where was Ahiah? Why did God have to go to the south, a Judean prophet, to tell Yeravim what he was doing wrong? Why not just go to Ahiah Shiloni and have Ahiah go over and slap Yeravim upside the head a few times and said, listen, I gave you a kingship, but you keep this up and you're doomed. Where was Ahiah during the entire story? Why is he not present during this entire incident? So now I want to, let me read on just, yeah, sorry. No, Ahiah. I was questioning where Ahiah was. Why did Ahiah disappear?
No, the previous, 2 weeks ago, whatever, they were told to rub up then, though, because when he triumphed...
Oh, yeah, that's true, but that was before the kingship. That was before the kingship.
No mission.
What?
God didn't tell him to go.
I said that. I want to know why. Why doesn't God tell him, bad move on the whole Egel thing? Obviously, God felt it was a bad move. Why would you go and get Judean prophet, which is less likely to be listened to be perfectly honest, I think. It's Ahiah's job. Why not go to Ahiah Shiloni? The question is, what was the relationship at the time between Yeravim and Ahiah? And I think you could probably take a guess, but let's continue off the story and see what happens.
Why is there a yud if to the word ah?
Oh,
if to the word what?
Yeah, it could be what's called a feminine case ending, I think, in this case. What that means is who and whom. So do you know how in English there's some case endings where if something is the subject or the object, it has a different letter that ends off the word? In English, we have almost no case endings. In German, for instance, you have all kinds of case endings. Der, das, die, dem, den. So in ancient Hebrew, there actually were some case endings, and this may be a feminine case ending which dropped off. When Ezra came, the question is, who did this correction from Ati to At? Nobody knows for sure. It may have been Ezra. By the time Ezra comes back, he probably doesn't recognize or agree with the case ending, so he probably makes a modification to remove it. That's my guess. That's not always the reason why there's two different, a spelling and a pronunciation is different. Sometimes it's because the spelling is a bad word. Like in the Tochacha it says, Tishagelna, right, your daughters will be Tishagelna, whatever that means, and whatever it is so bad that somebody decides to change it to the word Tishkavna. Take a look in Kitavo, that's what it's changed. Because it's such a bad word, they have to change it. In this case, there's a different reason. My guess is because the case ending was removed, but that's just a guess.
Yeah, I'm just saying that they take the yud out.
Originally, it was probably Ati. I could tell you, by the way,
what's
it used to be...
What's the cup?
Yeah. Kri, which means you read at. Yeah. I can tell you, by the way, if you look at Dead Sea Scrolls, there's no such thing as who and he. It's hua and hiya. And where do you have that? You have it only on haim. Sometimes you have haim, but sometimes you also have haima, right? You're familiar with haima?
Yeah.
So you have haima, which is actually became a masculine ending, even because of the hay. But at the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were saying hua and hiya, even though 100 years later, that was, or 200 years after the destruction of the temple, that was all lost. So sometimes you get these weird things which are simply removed because they go out of style. Anyway, v'halach shilo, you go to shilo, hinei sham achiyah shilo, v'hu diber alai, hu diber alai l'melech al ha'am hazeh. He's the one who told me that I should be the king of this nation. What's that? I think he's trying to say that because he's the one who may be the king, he owes me. He supports me. I think that's the idea. Of course, the other question is, why is she dressing up? But we'll see.
But didn't he tell it to Yeravim in private so that he was covering himself too?
What's that?
When Ahiyah said that.
Yeah. But I think most people...
He might have mentioned it to his wife.
People always say that, you know, I'm willing to keep a secret to anybody except my wife. But my guess is that after it happened, I think probably it became accepted that, I think it became public knowledge. I think it was private because he didn't want Shlomo to go bananas right away, but he wanted to have time to have the rebellion ferment. I can't believe that afterwards it wasn't known. Ahiah certainly writes the story. The question was whether it was kept hush-hush for a few hundred years. But my guess is that people know. Most of the Mefarshim say they knew right away, which is why everybody sent for Yeravim in the first place, because they all knew about it. Ahiah's prophecy.
You know, in this translation, it's not that she dressed herself up, but rather she disguised herself.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I'm sorry.
Oh.
I apologize.
You said dress herself
and
up.
And that probably makes to make herself fancy.
Yeah, you know, to, you know, like
sorry.
Seduction type.
Yeah, no. I apologize. No, Ahiah's old. there's no seduction going on. Hishtanit yeah. means to costume, to disguise. That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
I apologize. Yeah. I'm sorry, was there another question, Tom? Yeah.
Shiloh is a little bit to the north of Beit El.
You know, as you're driving on the road north of Yerushalayim, so the first town you run into is Beit El. If you keep going north about 20 minutes by car, you're in Shiloh. They're both in Shevet. Beit El is on the border of Shevet Ephraim and Shevet Binyamin. Shiloh is dead center in the middle of Shevet Ephraim. Just as the bird flies, it's probably 5 miles up the road.
Didn't move any since?
No. Not only that, we've dug up ancient Shiloh. They know exactly where it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt whatsoever. They even dug up like part of what may have been the Mishkan. It's well known exactly where Shiloh is. No doubt at all. So, Hine Shamachya Vudi Ber Alayla Melech Alamazeh. Pasuk Gimel, V'lakachat. I hate to get into grammar. I don't want to bore anybody. But in modern Hebrew, that would be V'lakacht. But in ancient Hebrew, it's not. And this is not an accident. This is the normal. If you don't believe me, V'shoma'at, this is the way it is. It's L'kachat, not L'kacht. That's how it is in biblical Hebrew. Why it later turned out into L'kacht, I don't know at what point it changed. But this is the correct form. V'lakachat, biyadech asara lechem, v'nikudim u'bakbuk dvash uvat elav, and come to him, hu yagid lach, and he'll tell you what's going to happen with the boy.
What are
see, I would have thought. Oh, Nikudim, good question. Nikudim are pot and kismin. What that means is cakes.
Ah.
Cakes. Fancy desserts. So bring to him bread, cakes, honey cakes, stuff like that. Bakbuk was wine and honey. And you come to him, Ruhu Yagilach Ma Yelanar. And I have to say, before you mentioned what you did, I would have said, let's see whether the boy's going to live or die. Now I'm not sure what the question is. I don't know. Why wouldn't he be the king? What is he looking for? I still tend to think that he was worried that he was going to die.
There's no significance to the whole halakha. I
would agree with you.
Yeah, why bribe unless you're worried that you have to get good news?
I mean, it doesn't tell you he was deathly sick.
I agree.
It could have been just a lingering... something, and
like
he's not getting better, but he's not deathly sick. He's just not getting better.
I think you have to say though the king believed that he was deathly ill, because otherwise, why do the whole? I can't really resolve this, and your point is still well taken, even though the rest of the story is difficult to read that way. But on the other hand, it's true. It doesn't say chalalamut. I believe what's going on here. Is why would you take all this stuff? First of all, why is she dressing up? Oh, we're going to see actually why she dressed up in a second. Let me continue on. I always ask questions before I finish. Why she apologize? Why she disguises herself? Vataas kein eishet yiravam vatakam v'teil Shiloh. So she goes to Shiloh. Vatavo beit achia. She comes to the house of achia. V'achia u lo yachol lirot. He can't see. Kamoi nami sevo. He's so old he can't see. Now what's interesting is who's the sound?
To get dressed up.
They're going to dress up anyway.
Yeah, I think couldn't say it.
Yeah, but there's another thing going on, because in Pasuk Bet, it says, V'lo yede'u, and they won't know. So the question is, who? His spies, people coming to town. He's worried that this all, he's really trying to keep it on the secret that the king is asking for this type of help from Achiah Shiloni. And we're going to have to revisit why so hush-hush, if Achiah Shiloni is a prophet, why do you have to hush-hush, and why do you have to bribe? But anyway, let's continue. Oh, by the way, as soon as you see this guy's eyes can't see anymore, it should immediately remind you of a few interesting characters. One, what's that? Yitzchak is an interesting idea. And Chazal tied into Yitzchak. I'm going to get to that in a second. No, Moshe says, "Lo naslecho." I was thinking of Eli. Eli was another blind prophet with kids that he didn't know. But in that sense, he was blind. He didn't know what was going on. He didn't know what was going on.
But you know, this doesn't follow. Like, your question doesn't follow. Why did she disguise herself if he doesn't see? Because this could have been a recent condition. I mean, who knows? The prophet doesn't see now. I mean, is it advertised?
It could be. I think that dress doesn't only.
Is it in the Daily News or something?
I think that's just walking up to Shiloh because of the plural. It says "Velo Yedu" in Pasuk Bet. Probably as you're walking up to Shiloh, people would stop and run ahead to the prophet and say, look who's coming to visit you. It's the queen. And this way, essentially, it's a surprise visit directly from the king who proxies to the queen to the prophet. He wants to leave the prophet in the dark until the last minute.
No. My point is that we don't know that the prophet is blind.
What do you mean?
I mean,
she doesn't know.
Yeah. No. When she's leaving, Or the king tells it to go. He doesn't know that the prophet is blind.
I don't know. It says Vachiyat lo yachol lirot ki kamoi nav misevo, because he's blind from old age. I don't think that's a. I don't think he just got knocked with blindness. I think he's old and he can't see. Mm-hmm. That's my sense. Anyway, let's see what happens in the story and then see if we can analyze the text. Vahashem amar el Achiyahu. So God peeks into Achiyahu. Says he nei eshet yeravam ba lidrosh davar meimach el banaki cholehu. He comes lidrosh. Now lidrosh is a very significant word. Lidrosh means to find out a future telling or to do what's called a soothsaying. That is a negative word in Malachim. I'm not going to have time to prove it to you today. Maybe I'll do it next week, because I'll have to take you all over Sefer Malachim. Sefer Malachim uses the word Lidrosh Elohim incredibly negatively, as opposed to Sefer Divrei Hayamim, which thinks of the word very positively. And I'll explain to you afterwards, as soon as we finish the story, why I think Lidrosh is a negative word, what the connotations are. So anyway, so Yeravam is, Achiyashinu is told that this is the wife of the king coming to look for a fortune-telling, a soothsaying. El banaki cholehu, because he's sick, kazo v'chazeh tedaber eleha. You tell her the following. And kazo v'chazeh is just a say of saying, you know, insert conversation here, so as not to repeat. So that's really what it is. God actually told him what to say, but it's removed by the editor just to put in the word kazo v'kazeh. A little bit like yada, 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 but that's not right. No, that's not right. God didn't say yada, yada, yada. So anyway, v'hi ki vo'ah, v'hi mitnakera. And when she comes, she's mitnakera. That's from the word nochri, which means she's acting as a fake. She's acting as a stranger. V'hi kishmo achiyah kol ragleo ba'abafetach. As soon as she hears the footsteps come in, v'yomer bo'i eishet yiravim. Come on in, eishet yiravim. Right? He's not fooled. Lama zeh at mitnakera. Who are you trying to fool, essentially? I believe that's the best way to translate. It's not why are you dressing up, but who do you think you're trying to fool? Vanochi shaluach elayach kasheh. Why? The vav here is because I am sent to you, shaluach. Shaluach is, it's called a past participle. It's like the word katuv. It has been written. Shaluach means I'm already sent to you. I personally have been established as a messenger, already sent and sealed, kasha. That is, anything you come to me is going to be negative. Now this, by the way, is clearly known by Yeravam. Why would she dress up? She would dress up because the feeling was that the king is no longer, at least from this passage, the king is no longer, he's a persona non grata when it comes to the king. So the king believes that if he fakes out, if he goes in as the king, the prophet will have nothing to do with him, because the prophet, every time he goes to listen to the prophet, he gets yelled at. We're told how fast he's going to die, essentially. Every time, so what does he figure? Let me dress up a fake. My wife will fake out the prophet. He won't know, and he'll sometime tell something about this anonymous child based on the goods that we're giving him. It starts to give you a picture of what Yeravam's mindset was. But he says, listen,
he doesn't tell who the child is.
How could they possibly do the prophecy? Excellent question. So I'll get back to that in a second. Excellent question. What? Harshly. Anish shaluach alai kasha, the way that the Radak adds a word, Anish shaluach alai dvarim kashim, I am sent to you with bad tidings or something like that. It's just, it's like, I'm an agent of evil. What?
The translation here is evil tidings.
Yeah, and it's adding in the word tidings, which is clearly not there. Yeah, kasha is just like a, think of it as like a recognized word, like I'm here to read you the Riot Act. I think it's just sort of recognizes what it means.
God tells you.
Yeah, but I got, but it would be like saying I got bad for you. It's almost slang. It sounds almost, it sounds like really kind of slangy. But it's not something that you wouldn't hear. Yeah.
God tells Achiyahu that she's coming to inquire about her son.
Yeah, that's correct. That's right.
Yeah.
That is, Achiyah knows exactly why, but Achiyah is not interested in hearing about the son. I'm sorry, Achiyah Shiloni, because Achiyah is like, why are you bothering coming? Because I'm the word of doom when it comes to your family. So what are you coming to me for help for? That's what she says. Anyway, let's continue on. L'chi imrili yiravam. So I want you to go back and tell your husband. Ko amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael. This is what God says. Yan asher mitocha mitocha am. Because I raised you up from the people. Va'atencha nagid al ami. That's also vavei poch. And I made you, past tense, a leader for my people, Yisrael. And I ripped apart the kingdom from the house of David. And I gave it to you. But you didn't do what I told you to do. You didn't behave like David. Asher shamar mitzvotai, who listened to my mitzvot. Asher alach acharai b'chol b'babol la'asot racha eshar b'enai. You didn't act like David. That was part of the deal. Vatara la'asot b'chol asher ayu l'fanecha. Not only that, you were worse than who came before you, which we're going to have to look at because nobody came before you, Rabban, theoretically, right? Because he's the first king in the north. We'll have to see what that means. Vatase lecha Elohim acharim u'ma'asichot achiseni. By the way, this sort of goes against my theory that the Egel was not an avoda klilim, because this specifically says Elohim achirim. So I'm just going to fudge this a little bit. I can't, you know, what can I tell you? Sometimes when the facts don't agree with your theory, it's best to avoid the fact. Me, by the way, is not Achiyashalinia. It's God talking here. And me, you threw behind your back. You tossed me out. I'm going to bring evil to the house of Yeravam. V'hichrati li'Yeravam mashtin bakir. And I'm going to wipe out for Yeravam, translated literally means someone who urinates on the wall. What that exactly means is not clear, but what it's talking about is there won't be even a situation where, I think, according to some of Farshim, it means even the dogs will be killed, the dogs who usually go against the wall. The other possibility, by the way, is like a homeless person. You know, somebody doesn't have a house, he goes wherever he goes, which means it won't just be that the main house of Yeravam will be destroyed. The implication is that, you know, nobody from the house, the most minor servant who goes out, you know, in the yard, he will also be wiped out. That's what Mashdin Bakir means. Simply translated, it just means total devastation. Atzur Vazuv for Yisrael is very important words, because those words show up in anybody recognize those words? Atzur Vazuv, the Efes Atzur Vazuv, it says in Hazinu. So it's a little difficult. People in Farshim have a very difficult time. But again, without translating it directly, it probably means something like there won't even be left people who are Atzur, which means tied up in a building, which means people in fortification, what do you call it when they're being besieged? People being besieged. Vaziv are like the homeless and the wanderers of Israel. Uviarti acharei be yiram kasher yivair hagalal atumo. And I will either burn away or eat away, depending on which way you want to go, the house of Yeravam, just like the galal is burnt away. Galal is also a difficult word. It can be a stone. It might mean wheat, which is how Uncleus translates it, and it might also mean human excrement, like the way human excrement dries up and flakes away. I think Rashi brings that second opinion. Hamately Yeravam ba'ir yachlua klavim. Anybody who dies in Yeravam's house in the city, the dogs will eat him. Vameit basaden, somebody who dies in the fields, yachlu ofa shamayim, the birds of the sky will eat him. Ki Hashem diber. Ki, by the way, doesn't mean because there. It means
thus said.
Or really, really. You know what ki, the best way to translate ki there is really, really.
That Hashem has spoken.
Four is a good word. Va'at kumi l'chila veitech. And you get out of here. Go home. Bivo'ara. Now here, this is the wicked part, and now we're going to have to see what happens. Bivoar raglayecha ira umeita yelet. That is a pun. You follow what I'm saying? It's not that he's already going to be dead. Well, yeah, that's a participle, umate. And he will die, which means the implication is you, as soon as you're returning home, that will cause him to die. That's a powerful statement, which makes it sound, again, like his death was not so much guaranteed. It makes it sound, and again, here I want to go a little bit here, that the death is not guaranteed until they do this act. Do you follow? That is, it is the act of going to find out this prophecy, all decked out and faked out, and bringing the bribes to the prophet. It's that act which causes the death of the child.
Grammatically, she could have made tshuva there. Not gone home, prayed, and maybe she would have turned around, hypothetically.
That's right, but she doesn't. Exactly. But she doesn't. The question is, does she even understand what it... You know what?
This kind of brings to mind what happened with Dovin when he fasted on the first son of Bathsheba, hoping that he would live.
Correct. Why does that bring to mind? I would have said it's sort of the opposite, because she doesn't react to it at all.
Yeah, but if she had any historical consciousness, she'd say, oh yeah, there was a previous king who also... fasted greatly on his son, so by his saying that, she could could have read into it and said, oh, so this is a hope for my son.
I agree. I think that's where, and I'm reading a line from the text. I think this is a difficult parak, or I don't understand this parak so well. My belief is this is a continuation of the misunderstanding that Yeravim and his wife have for what prophecy is all about. A drasha mantra is something else. Lidrosh Elohim is a soothsaying. The feeling is that if you give the man of God, that is, obviously the bribe is important here, or it never would have been recorded for us. Obviously that's annoying to the prophet, to say the least. My feeling is here, and it's just I can't prove anything. The fact that they think that they could trick a prophet is an indication that they have no idea what prophecy is all about. Not only that, it's an indication that if I wanted to find out from God, let's say I knew that a prophet's job was to help me to communicate with God if God wants me to talk, I've got to identify the child. I have to say, will boy X live or die? I can't go to an Urim V'Tumim and say, hey, will Israel ever win a war? I mean, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. It's nonspecific. Not only that, what do we know about the Urim V'Tumim? There's a famous case by David where he asked two questions and only gets the answer to one of them. As a famous Chazal would say, if he asked, you only ask one question at a time. Because you have to be understanding that the Urim V'Tumim is merely a means of communicating to God. You can't fool them. And people, you can't. The idea here is that they are bribing the man of God because somehow they believe that the man of God has power to save an anonymous child. They'll give him money. He'll cut a check that says your child will be perfectly fine. That's my feeling here. I have a hard time reading it another way. What might be happening, but I'm not sure, is because that problem is endemic to their entire problem, because Yerubbaal and his wife are those kind of people, which, by the way, matches perfectly with the whole idea of the ego. Because maybe once upon a time, I might have only thought that I'm worshipping through the ego to God. But in the end, Avodah Zarah is Avodah Zarah, and all of a sudden, I'm not worshipping through the ego anymore, I'm worshipping to the ego. So what happens is that Avodah Zarah becomes something of Avodah Kalilim. And I think that's what's happening here, where they're looking for soothsaying. They've returned to the very pagan origins which they were told not to become when they came back to Canaan, and that's why Aviah is condemned to death based on his father's actions, not his previous actions, but the actions that are happening right now.
He wasn't too sick.
Well, it may be. It's possible, yeah. It's possible. It does support that theory a little bit. Yeah. It does. It does support that theory a little bit. Yeah.
Where did you draw the conclusion that this was an attempt to drive to get him to give a good prophecy?
Well, I'll tell you something. Going back to
Pasuk, I can read this very easily, that this was the custom when you go to the soothsayer, you bring him a...
Not only that, you have proof for your words, which I was going to mention, which is backed by Sefer Shmuel. I'm sorry, you're going to say something?
No, I had the same question. I mean, people give, let's say, Rabbanim,
they shouldn't, but
they go to a Rebbe,
and the Rav shouldn't accept it.
They give the teachers, and they give, and supposedly it's not really given as a bribe, it's given as a thank you for what, the efforts that they put in. And
so or that you're going to, it's like thanking somebody in advance. I can tell you a story about...
That's a seeing me and giving me a dip.
Yeah,
I could tell you a story, by the way, an interesting story about Nechama Leibovitz, since you mentioned the issue of Rabbanim.
Yeah.
Nechama Leibovitz would never take the smallest, tiniest gift from any student, and she taught thousands. And so I, in fact, know somebody, I'm not going to mention his name, but went to her house, a real chassid of hers. He went to her house with a present just to show, I think he was leaving Israel to come back to America, and he wanted to give her a present for all that he taught her. And she apologized, and she said, I can't take such a thing. That's because she wouldn't take a thing.
Yeah.
She never would. Because she doesn't believe, because she didn't believe in thank yous, I don't think. I think she believed in bribes. Or she believed there was a bribe. So there's a question whether Rabbanim should be. It's also to take money. So I wonder whether a teacher or a Rav should be the same. However, I want you to know something. I agree with you. So I may blow another one of my theories. I'll tell you why. Because the story about Shaul was wandering around looking for his donkey, and he goes to his nar and he says, "Man navil le roeh, what should we bring to the roeh?" Because apparently it was a custom to bring a little bit of a pittance to the roeh. So in my own defense, but I'm not sure I'm right, I think there's a difference between a pittance and Nikudim and Esalechem and Yayin, and if somebody gets me a tie, that's fine. But if somebody gets me a car, I got problems. You know what I mean?
But when a king is sending,
but he didn't know it was a king. That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
But he did know.
But he wasn't supposed to know. He wasn't supposed to know. I don't know if it was a bribe. To be honest, I don't know. I want to know. I may be wrong about the parsha. It could be that Yerubam is already doomed in the previous chapter with the Egel Zahav. It could be he's already doomed. And therefore, this is just a commentary about how Achia didn't like him, and I'm going to get back to that in the last 10 minutes.
Well, it's not a question of what Achia felt. Achia was he wasn't giving his opinion. This is what God told him to say.
That's correct, but Achia had already... You're right.
He's just a vehicle here. He's not a...
So now let's talk... That's true, but by the fact that the king had to have her, disguise herself, I think the impression is that anything that comes from the king will be immediately rejected.
Well, I can see a scenario where the public at large didn't know the king's son was so sick, or was sick at all for that matter.
So he was supposed to keep it under the wraps.
So he's sending his wife in disguise.
It's possible.
That people shouldn't know.
It's possible. It's not in the text, but it's certainly possible. And I'm reading stuff in, so there's no reason why. There is a little to read in. I'll tell you a little. We only have about 10 minutes left, so I want to give you a little surprise. According to Chazal, what do they call it? The Sunday surprise? The October surprise? According to Chazal, Yerubam was supported in his idea to build the Egel by Achia Shiloni. I'll repeat that, but it reverses it, so it's clear. Achia Shiloni accepted the building of the Egel, which is why he doesn't show up in the Egel story, because he did not think the Egel was a problem. This is what Chazal say in Gemara Sanhedrin. I don't know why Chazal take a rough opinion. Chazal also say, you know who becomes blind? People whose students are of the Avodah Zarah, because the smoke of Avodah Zarah goes right into their eyes and makes their eyes weak. There's a criticism there. It doesn't mean that the people are of the Avodah Zarah themselves, but there's the criticism that the father allowed the child to get away with stuff that he shouldn't. Anybody who says to you about Yitzchak, of course, anybody who tells you Yitzchak that his eyes got blinded because of the... And that's one opinion. This is not historical. I'm telling you an opinion in Chazal. And when I say an opinion in Chazal, it doesn't mean the only opinion in Chazal. The main opinion in Chazal is that Yitzchak's eyes were weak because... His eyes were open on the, I'm sure you know the story, his eyes were open on the, when he was up for a sacrifice, and the angels cried, and the tears dripped down into his eyes, and that weakened his eyes. That would be the majority opinion. However, the minority opinion says the Avodah Zarah smoke got in his eyes. What do you think it was, a barbecue? The impression is that Yitzchak did not stop his son, even though he was aware that his son was not completely off the derech. You also get that impression with the wives. The wives don't become an issue until after the bracha is taken. But before that, Yishmael causes great grief to his parents. Right? Afterwards, Esav says, you know, I better marry the right type of girl. That happens after the bracha incident. But before the bracha incident, Esav goes off and marries, you know, the worst type. Where were the parents? You know, did they disown him? Did they not go to chuppah? Exactly what was going on. It's hard to say. But there is a certain criticism. So too is there a criticism here about the eyes blindness thing that Chazal do bring up. I can't say that it's a majority opinion, although it does show up in the Gemara, which is a powerful statement. When Medrash gets into a Gemara, that's a powerful statement. The question is, at what point did Achia Shiloni clearly doesn't want to have anything to do with him. At what point does Achia Shiloni refuse to have anything to do with him? I don't know. We just have no information. At the end of the story, we know Achia won't even talk to him unless his wife dresses up. Unless you give this other theory that they were just dressing up to keep a low profile. But I don't think that's the sense, because she says, "Hine anochi shaluach alecha kasha." Everything you come to me, you're going to get bad news. Which they know, which is apparently why they wanted to dress up, because they figured they could fake him out.
Is that the right meaning of it?
Yeah, it means that I am nothing but bad news for you. But that means his opinion also is that his opinion is God's opinion. You're a bad guy, you
Ruffin. You came to see me, but I don't have any good news for you. I've got bad news for you.
No, I think it's harsher than that. I think what he's trying to say is, I am nothing but a prophet of doom for you.
Now, but couldn't he be
based on his actions?
Based on the message he's going to have to deliver.
Yeah.
No, shaluach is like katuv, chatum. It's called past participle. It means something which is like feel done. It's been there for a long time. When I say Zekatuv, that doesn't mean it's written out. Then I would say Zekotet, you know, Ani Nechta, Katuv, or Chatum, or Shaluach. That's like, you get the sense that it's been that way for a long time.
Rabbi, he had no free choice. The woman goes there, and God appears to him and says, you have to tell him.
No, that's not the way prophets work. That's not the way prophets work. How do I know that that's not the way prophets work? Because when David HaMelech asked Natan if he could build a Beit HaMikdash, what does Natan say? He says, go Beit HaMikdash. And then Hashem goes, he says, that's the wrong thing. No, Nevi'im have their own ability to work. They don't get prophecy. This is a famous Rambam. A Navi may have prophecy five times in his life. Just because you have prophecy, that's not the only thing that makes you a Navi. It's not the thing that, just because a Navi is fully capable of working based on what he believes God will say, based on his understanding of the situation.
Go
a prophet's not like just a telephone.
But he told
him Moshe.
The woman comes there, he probably wouldn't recognize the king's son unless he was told, she's coming.
And therefore, okay, I'm with you, but what are you trying to say?
She's coming, and here I have good news for you. You've got to tell her this.
I don't believe that they wanted him to talk to God at all. I don't think they're even... I think they think of him as a magic man. That's my sense of things.
The other way around.
What?
No. God told to the prophet.
He's a sorcerer.
You tell that lady,
who does she think she's kidding? Exactly
she
right.
No idea. She didn't know that he was told before that she's coming.
I'm aware of that. But obviously, if she believed that God was talking to the prophet, then whether she puts on a Superman mask does not make a difference.
No.
She doesn't believe he's talking to God.
It doesn't make a difference for her, but it means that he got the word from God to tell her. She could have come there. He would have never seen her because he was too old and he had no idea who was coming here. But before she came...
Yeah, but that's not the sense you have with the word Shaluach Alecha Kasheh. Shaluach Alecha Kasheh seems to give the impression that God has given me 5 years ago the word on you and I want to have enough... And everything else that I'm going to tell you is going to be a bad thing. My attitude towards you, mine through God, you know... God's not going to speak to him every minute. If they came up and said, "Achi, Ashili, how things are going," he would say, "Things are going very bad, Yerubim. You're a bad guy." He didn't need to get a prophecy for that type of thing at all. The prophecy that he got was to find out that Abia was going to die. That was a shocker. And what I wanted to say more shockingly is Abia is going to die because of this irresponsibility, which is happening now, that the king thinks that he could go and fool a prophet.
The king is home. The kid is sick. The wife gets the message. She comes home, and as she comes home, the kid dies. So the king himself had no idea really what was going to happen until the wife comes or is there or whatever.
Yeah, actually, what's going to happen, by the way, is she doesn't die and she gets in the house.
Right.
Yeah, but well,
are
right
we to assume
but
that
you're right? The king did not know his son was going to die.
Oh, yeah.
Are
well,
we to assume that the son would have?
If he sent her to find out.
He was probably hoping for good news.
Exactly.
The question is, first of all, am I reading it right? I don't know if I want to know this whole part. I don't even know if I'm reading it right. Is it in fact that the boy died because she walked into the town? That's the way I'm reading it, but it doesn't have to be that way. It could have been incidental. By the time you get back, the boy
that's
will be dead.
Means.
That's not the simple... How does the English read that pasuk? I'm curious. How does the pasuk read...
Pasuk
Yud Bet.
Yud Bet, it says...
That doesn't mean the child will already be dead. That means that's causative. Because, obviously, God's not just saying, let's have a little fun here and let's make both happen at the same time just for a good laugh. It's obviously causative. It's when you get in, that footstep in the town is going to make him die. That's a causative. That means that she's causing his death based on the way that the king and the queen are acting now.
That
do we have
isn't the way I feel when I read that.
Very,
I
very
feel
similar.
Like he's saying... When you get back, as you get there, that's when he's going to die.
Yeah, I think
yeah,
that's right. Because,
sort of
you know, the implication is that if she decided not to go back, the boy wouldn't have died.
Yeah, I don't
if she went to
that's
off
right.
somewhere.
That's right. I think that's
I
the idea. If she would have done tshuva. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. There's always the possibility. Old prophecy has the possibility to do tshuva. You think it's just an incidental thing? And that's just a soothsaying, the boy's going to die.
Yeah.
And it was just bad luck, which means, according to what you're saying, she could have dressed up as the queen. Yerubim himself could have gone to Shiloh and said, you know, I really have a question I'd like to ask God. He would have said, sure, shoot. And he would have said, is my son going to live? And he would say, let me check. No. You said, that's
sort of what I'm getting, but you're...
My question is, why all the drama of the story?
You're right. I
don't know. The truth is, I don't know how to read this.
I think it's
parak.
Trying to show us that because they didn't do tshuva, the boy died. If they had done tshuva, the boy might have lived.
I tell you, this is a very difficult parak. I said last parak was hard. Last parak wasn't hard at all compared to this. There, let's just spell out. We only have 2-3 minutes. Let's spell all the possibilities. One is that Achi Ashiloni theoretically could have given her a... There was one possibility. Achi and the king never had any problem whatsoever. They were all friendly.
But he didn't say to her that you know...
Because of what you did.
Yeah, because of what you did, or because you're being punished, or...
He said, you know what he says? He says, because you weren't... All he says, and here, I want you to know something. I'm going to read in, and this is not fair of me. I'm going to read in Pasuk Tet. Vatara lasot mikol asher ayu lefanecha. You've done worse than anybody's ever done before you. Vatelech vatasalecha Elohim acherim umasechot umahachiseni. Now, the masecha, we know exactly what that is. What's the masecha? The ego. So what are the Elohim acherim? Is it also the, now you could say that's also the ego, which means Elohim acherim umasechot doesn't really mean and, it means which are. And you could say above means that, although it's a little bit unusual. This seems to give impression that there's something else besides the ego. The masechot are clearly the ego. That we saw because the ego masecha is from the Torah, and the masecha, it's always been a masecha. The full image of the ego is probably incorrect. You know, the Charlton Heston thing with the full image of the ego is probably correct. It was probably a mask in an ego shape. So, vatasel echad, you've made for yourself, Elohim acherim umasechot lachiseini, seems to be saying that he's doing something even worse than what you've seen in chapter 13. But we've never seen him do any Elohim Achirim. The only thing I've seen him do bad is this whole incident with the prophet. And therefore, I'm going to read in here, and very possibly read in incorrectly, and say, the fact that they're going to try to make things up and bribe a prophet so that he won't even know who he... They're expecting a blessing, like a bracha. It's almost Christian. I don't want to insult Christianity. And that's not really fair, because Christianity, you could argue, is ex-cathedra. It's like a magic man. You bring the unnamed child, and the unnamed child lays his hands on the head, and he doesn't care who it is. He's a happy guy, and he takes some of his powers, and he saves the kid. Because they didn't even know who the kid was going to be. Unless you argued that she was going to, after she got to the house, she was going to take off, you know, her makeup and say, it's really me. I want to tell you what's really going on. I was flying incognito. But that's not my impression. My impression is that she was going to stay incognito, because if she didn't, Achi Ashiloni would have nothing to do with her. Which means that even if Chazal are right, that Achi Ashiloni would have accepted the ego worship. According to Chazal, if the Chazal are right, that Achi would have accepted the ego worship, he must have done something else that he would not have accepted. What are these Elohim Achirim? I don't know. What else did Yeravim do that was so not Yashar that he's reading him a death act? I don't know.
In addition to that, I have a problem with the word Vahachi Seini. Because Vahachi Seini is not a passive word. You consciously did that to get me angry.
You have to read it in Dvarim and in Vayikra Lahachiseni. Lahachiseni means it caused me to be angry. But that's how people understand the modern word lahachis. Lahachis means you're doing it specifically to make sure to get the goal. It could be. I'm not sure. That's why people are over the avodah zarah, just to annoy God. I think the fact that it's just a joke. There are probably better ways to go about it.
You did this so that I would be angry.
Yeah, I don't. I think that's a modern translation of the word lachis. I'm not comfortable with that as an ancient translation of the word.
It doesn't make sense. We know you're the real God, but we just want to really annoy you.
Yeah.
Why would they do that, though?
I have no idea.
Who knows why kings and people do what they do?
In Pasuk Lamed Gimel, it says, after this incident, Yeravim did not repent from his evil way.
That's right.
And he again appointed commoners of people as priests for high priests.
Where are you? At the end of chapter 13.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Say why? This is, tells you why. Why he's being punished.
But not punished to death. He never got read the riot act. When the prophet came up from the south and read him a riot act about the eagle, he was never read the riot act that everybody in his family was going to be destroyed, killed, until Moses left.
In Pasuk 34, it says this man becomes a source of punishment for the house of Yeravim,
yes,
to eradicate it and destroy it from the face of the earth. It says that in Pasuk 34. Lamed Gimel.
And you're equating that prophecy with the prophecy that Achiah gives him. Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, that's the introduction.
Yeah, in which,
chapter 14.
If that's
it's not
true.
A prophecy, it's like an editorial statement. You know?
Yeah, you know, like, you know, this is what the preamble is. And
yeah, it's, you know, Larry's point is a good point. That's an editorial statement made by probably Yirmiyahu. Because of the Egel, that's why Yeruvim was destroyed. I'm not sure that was Achiah's opinion, and I don't believe that Chazal believed that's Achiah's opinion, because Chazal say, again, buy it or not, but Chazal say that Achiah was supportive of the Egel. There must have been something else going on. Okay, we're already over time. I leave you with the idea, is this incident merely a very interesting story about how Yeruvim was a sneaky, lousy fellow, and it didn't help him at all, and he was going to get rid of the same riot act that he got read in chapter 13, and it's all the Egel? That's one possibility. Or is this incident symptomatic of his break with his main prophet, his refusal to listen to his main prophet, to the point where he believes that he could fake out his old prophet, like faking out the old teacher when, you know, they don't know what's going on, so that as if a prophet's an idiot that could be faked or fooled, because there's no real sense of what prophecy, what God is all about, and that causes the death and destruction of Yeruvim. Is chapter 14 symptomatic of a more serious problem than the Egel, or is it merely just a very interesting story that ends it off? I prefer the former, because I always want the content not simply to be interesting, but to be meaningful. There must be something here which, if it wasn't here, would the book be acceptable? If you follow what I'm saying? If the chapter was left out, would we have still understood Yeruvim? If you say this story is incidental to the main sin of the Egel, then it's a good story. It certainly fleshes out the characters, but it's not a critical story. The way that I was teaching it today, it becomes a more critical story. However, I really have no proof. I just want to mention, we're already over time, what happens is she comes back to the house. She steps foot in the house in a city called Tirzah, which means that he moved his capital city again. Tirzah is about 10 kilometers north of Shechem, which means it comes back over. If I remember, I told you he jumped to the other side of the Jordan River when things were in trouble. Obviously, when Aviah came to power, as I mentioned, he's trying to reconcile. He does it. According to Chazal, he does a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Things are going a little better. And the capital city is actually moved to the correct side of Israel, to a place called Tirzah, which is 10 miles north of Shechem. Shechem was probably still too hot. She steps in the city, and that's it. They die. And that's the end of the life. His story is written in Divrei Hayamim leMalchei Yisrael, and he ruled for 22 years, and he died, and his son Nadav, who's not going to make it a long time, comes to power. This is not the destruction of his family house. Next chapter, we'll see the rebellion against Yerubim's family house, and that's where all of Yerubim's family will be destroyed.
Chapter 15,
we'll get the destruction. The house of Omri, which is the most powerful house, is on the rise. Have a good night.